This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And we are with you for a special with Chris Hedges, the days of destruction and the days of revolt. Chris Hedges, a Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent, set out to look at those areas in America that have been offered up for exploitation in the name of profit, progress, and technological advancement to show what life looks like in places where the marketplace rules without constraints, where human beings and the natural world are used and then discarded to maximize profit. The result? The days of destruction. Days of revolt.
Hedges talks about the Western Plains, where Native Americans were sacrificed in the race for land and empire. He then travels to the old manufacturing centers and the coal fields that fueled the Industrial Revolution, but now lie depleted and in decay, and then looks at the slave-like conditions of immigrant farm workers in Florida.
Hedges talks about the people at the bottom of the American economy, and he argues that without profound change, poverty will deepen and flood the nation. He then talks about reversal and remedy, how to bring people out in protest and to rebuild the kind of movements that protect us, such as Occupy, where a new generation revolted against the corporate state of by and for the 1% that bequeathed to us an economic, political, cultural, and an environmental catastrophe. So we want you to get ready and sit back to be with you, Building Bridges with Chris Hedges. So let's hear him.
The mantra within this faux liberal class is the same mantra that you find within the neoconservatives. And that is that we as citizens must kneel before the dictates of the marketplace. It's an absurdity. 3,000 years of economic history, there's nothing to support the idea that human societies should be built around the dictates of the marketplace. And that has become our utopian vision. And I use the word utopia the way Thomas More coined it in 1516. Utopia literally means no place. It doesn't exist. And we are being disempowered by an ideology that is rapidly creating a kind of global neo-feudalism, a world of masters and serfs, a world where the American worker, like workers in all of the industrialized countries, are being told that they have to be competitive on in a global marketplace, which means being competitive with prison labor in China or sweatshop workers in Bangladesh who make 22 cents an hour. And so Sacco and Joe Sacco, I met Joe in Bosnia in 1995. When he was working on his book, A Safe Area, Garajda. We went to Garajda together. I don't know much about graphic novels, but I know something about journalism, and I realized this was certainly one of the most brilliant journalists I'd met. He reports the story out, and then he draws it out. It's very labor-intensive. It takes him a very long time to do it. He did a book called Footnotes in Gaza, which is one of the masterpieces, one of the great works of the Palestine-Israel conflict. It took him 6 years to do. We wanted to do a book because we wanted to walk into the sacrifice zones, these places that have been sacrificed first, and make them visible. And as a graphic novelist, as a cartoonist, he can do things that even a photographer can't do. He can switch within the book, as it does, to describe people's lives and give it a kind of filmic quality. The whole point of the book, and I think what hopefully raised it to or gave it a kind of punch that it wouldn't have had with simple prose, is that we want you to be able to see. And what happened in these sacrifice zones, these are the places that went first. These were the places where corporate capital moved in and broke all forms of opposition. And we begin in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, Lakota Indian Reservation, second poorest county in the country. At the average life expectancy for a male in Pine Ridge is 48. That is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. At any one time, 60% of the dwellings in Pine Ridge, many of which are sod huts, have neither electricity or running water. Because what happened to the native communities is the template for the imperial adventures that took place in Cuba, the Philippines, that's taking place in Iraq, Afghanistan, and that is the template by which now the last vestiges of the country are, in business terms, a term Mitt Romney publicly uses, being harvested. You had railroad magnates, timber merchants, speculators, miners who wanted the land, saw the indigenous community as an impediment, killed off by the end 95% of them, drove them into what were at first called prisoner of war camps, then became Indian agencies, and then became reservations, broke the capacity for self-sufficiency, and created a culture of dependence. But even more importantly, I think, these indigenous communities had to be destroyed because they offered another ethic, another way of relating within a communal structure. Indigenous leaders who hoarded goods were despised within a native community. Everything was communal. And if you look at Karl Marx's notebooks, and they're not in the mainstream, I had to get it out of the rare book room in the Princeton University Library, you see detailed notations of the structure of Iroquois society. Marx and Engels were fascinated by how native indigenous communities structured their relationships to each other and the natural world. There's a very fine book by the economist Carl Polanyi, written in 1944, called The Great Transformation, in which he writes about unfettered, unregulated capitalism. And even though he's an economist, he uses the word sacred. He says that when a society loses the capacity for the sacred, when nothing has an intrinsic value, but everything has a monetary value, then for these forces which commodify the natural world and commodify human beings exploit them until exhaustion or collapse, which is why the environmental crisis is intimately twinned with the economic crisis. 40% of the summer Arctic sea ice melts, which should terrify all of us. And the response of the corporate state is to send up drill teams to mine the last vestiges of gas, oil, minerals, and fish stocks. It's insane. It makes Moby Dick the most prescient study of the American character to date. We are all on the Pequod. We are all led by Ahab, who said, "My methods and my means are sane. Only my object is mad." To allow the fossil fuel industry to determine our relationship to the planet, and I hope you're all on your vacation time going to go out and physically block the XL Keystone pipeline. These people are extracting the last bits of profit out of the death throes of the planet, and they will take us all down with them. If we let them, thank you. And we will all, if we don't resist, end up on one vast reservation. And that is, of course, what the security and surveillance state is about. I used to wonder, was Huxley right in terms of dystopia, or was Orwell right? Well, it turns out they were both right, because first we got Huxley. We were amused and entertained and seduced into a world of hedonism and easy credit and mass-produced goods. And once that credit dried up and those mass-produced goods were no longer cheap, we had already been economically and politically disempowered. And then we get Oceania. Then we get the Iron Boot of a much harsher form of totalitarianism, which of course began in our marginal communities, a night raid in Bedford-Stuy, or Oakland, in every way, resembles a night raid in Fallujah. There is no difference. The doors kicked down, dressed in black, Kevlar plates, command centers, automatic weapons, and when Imperiums die, they bring the harsher forms of control on the edges of empire back to the heart of empire. Thucydides wrote about it, about the death of Athenian democracy. He said, the tyranny Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself. And that's where we are. That's what's happening. I didn't mention one more assault on civil liberties by the Obama administration, and that's the National Defense Authorization Act. Section 1021, which authorizes the U.S. military for the first time in over 200 years to carry out the arrest of American citizens deemed to have substantially supported, whatever that means, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or something called associated forces. Hold them in military facilities without due process until, in the language of that section, the end of hostilities, which in an age of permanent war is probably forever. And in January, I sued the president and Leon Panetta. And I was joined by Daniel Ellsberg and Noam Chomsky. And in September, federal judge Catherine B. Forrest declared the law invalid. Now, the reaction of the Obama administration for me was quite telling. We knew they'd appeal, but they didn't just appeal. They asked Judge Forrest for a stay, meaning put the law back into effect until the appellate court can hear the case and make a ruling. She refused. That was a Friday afternoon. Late Friday night, the government attorneys handed it over to the Pentagon attorneys, who demanded an emergency hearing at 9 a.m. on Monday morning for an emergency appeal and an emergency stay, which they got. So the law became back in force, and we are now going through the appeal. They're hearing the appeal. Now that surprised us. The fact that the state would respond that aggressively could mean only one thing. They're already using the law. Because if they were holding American citizens in military facilities without due process, and that injunction was on the books, they would be in contempt of court. And so our suspicion is there are probably U.S.-Pakistani dual nationals sitting in cells in military holding facilities in places like Bagram and other places. After Pine Ridge, we went to Camden, New Jersey, per capita the poorest city in the United States. And not surprisingly, one of the most dangerous. Camden used to be an industrial center. 36,000 people used to work in its shipyards. Campbell Soup was made there. RCA Victor produced records there. It's all gone. And of course, as anybody who comes from a marginal community understands, you have invisible and visible walls that keep you hemmed in. And there is no way economically to walk out of a place like Camden. And if you rebel, you'll find yourself within the prison system. As the poet Yusuf Kumanyaka has said quite correctly, the cell block has replaced the auction block. That we've created through this prison network, we hold 25% of the world's prison population, most of whom are people of color. We've created a mechanism by which we disenfranchise our poor, and especially our people of color. I just came back from Alabama. 34% of African American males cannot vote because they have a criminal record. 34%, a number expected to rise to 40. And Camden becomes symptomatic of the move by the corporate state to move all of our manufacturing first over the border into Mexico, and now we're seeing large-scale factory closures as these factories migrate to the Philippines, Vietnam, the cut-rate embrace of China's totalitarian capitalism. And those left behind become, in the eyes of the corporate state, human refuse, human detritus. We went to the old coal fields of southern West Virginia. And there, of course, the coal companies no longer want to dig down for the coal seams. They blow the top 400 feet off of the mountains. We flew, Joe and I flew over the Appalachian Mountains, and it'll rip your heart out. Hundreds of thousands of acres of a wasteland with huge impoundment ponds, billion-gallon impoundment ponds filled with heavy metals and toxic sludge. The air is fetid. The water is fetid. We were in old coal camps down in these hollows where everyone in the town had their gallbladder removed because the water is so toxic. Cancer is an epidemic. You walk into the elementary schools, and you go to the nurse's office, and there are just rows of little inhalers for the children. That's what happens when you kneel before the marketplace. And finally, we go to Immokalee, Florida, where mostly undocumented workers pick our nation's produce without any kind of job security or legal protection. They gather at 4 in the morning, and these are, in the race to the bottom, Immokalee is the bottom. That is the awful logic of where we will end up if we don't begin to resist. They gather at 4 in the morning. They look for work. If they can't find work, they go home. They sleep in trailer parks, 20 to a trailer. They pay $50 a week. That's $2,000. These trailers should have been condemned years ago. And when they can't make enough, when they can't make that $50, they're thrown out. So all throughout Immokalee, you find encampments out in the woods, people living under mango trees. And not surprisingly, you see, and anybody who knows the history of Jim Crow and Reconstruction knows that slavery has always been part of Florida. That through convict leasing, through the terror of lynching, there has always been a population that has been held captive. And that's why you uncover slave operations to this day. We interviewed a worker who had been chained inside a truck at night with other workers. They were all forced to defecate in a corner of that truck. Three of the workers punched a hole in the roof and escaped. There was a police raid on the compound, and most of the workers wouldn't testify because they threatened their families back in Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala. And we found one of the workers who did testify. And of course, what happened is he was blacklisted. None of the crew leaders would give him work. And he's an alcoholic. Severe problem with alcoholism, and when we found him, he was sleeping at night under a mango tree. And that condition of slavery we are now beginning to see in this country replicated in other industries where there is no protection, like the hotel industry and the garment industry. This is the awful logic of corporate capitalism, of neo-feudalism, of a world that replicates the power structure that Orwell pointed out in 1984, where you have an inner party of about 4%, an outer party of 12 to 14%. These are the security forces, the corporate managers, and the rest of us become proles. Now, when we began the book, we always had the title Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, but the revolt was conjecture. And then we saw, on September 17th, the rise of Occupy. And Joe, who's based in Portland, we came out and that's the last chapter, Days of Revolt. And Occupy was a seminal moment in modern American history. for many reasons. First of all, it articulated a narrative that was real about power that had not been articulated for the mainstream before. It understood that all we have left are acts of civil disobedience, rebuilding movements that put pressure on the centers of power. And it understood that we have to reconfigure, if we are to survive as a nation and a species, how we relate to each other and how we relate to the natural world. And the response of the state in a coordinated effort was to eradicate, physically erase those encampments. Many of you, no doubt, read Paul Krugman in the New York Times, and Krugman's constant mantra, week after week, is a rational response to the economic crisis. A rational response. A rational response would mean, at a minimum, a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, a forgiveness of all student debt, a massive jobs program especially targeted at people under the age of 25, a rational healthcare system, Medicare for all, and let's throw in there putting Lloyd Blankfein and Robert Rubin in jail. But they didn't respond rationally. They told us that the only language they would speak to us in was the language of force. It's always the ruling class that determines the parameters of rebellion. They would have, by carrying out these rational reforms, dissipated the anger. Instead, they refused to extend unemployment benefits for hundreds of thousands of Americans, meaning tens of thousands of people are going to lose their homes, tens of thousands more. So what's coming? Something's coming. I've covered movements all over the world. I covered the two Palestinian uprisings, the intifadas. I covered the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania. I covered the street demonstrations that brought down Slobodan Milosevic. You know, as a reporter, and having spent 2 years in these sacrifice zones, you know something's coming. You never know when it's going to come. You never know what is going to ignite it. Even the purported leaders of these movements don't know. I was with the leaders of the East German opposition on November 9th, 1989, in which they said, perhaps within a year, there will be free passage back and forth across the Berlin Wall. Within a matter of hours, the Berlin Wall, at least as an impediment to human traffic, did not exist. We underestimate, in a moment when a power elite is that isolated and corrupt, the importance of resistance, because it keeps that other narrative alive, as Václav Havel did in Czechoslovakia from 1977 to 1989. As the leaders of the East German opposition did in Leipzig, week after week in candlelit vigils, as the Egyptian opposition did for years before they got those numbers within Tahrir Square. I was in Wenceslas Square in that winter of the Velvet Revolution. I used to spend every evening in the Magic Lantern Theater with Václav Havel, and all over the streets of Prague were posters of a young Charles University student, Jan Panich, who, to protest the Soviet occupation of Czechoslovakia in 1968, when they overthrew Dubček and reinstalled the Moscow regime, had gone to Wenceslas Square and burned himself and died 4 days later of his wounds. Thousands of university students carried his body to the cemetery. They were broken up by police. The entire self-immolation was never covered by the state media. When his grave became a shrine, they dug up his remains, cremated his body, gave them to his mother, and told her that she was not allowed to rebury them. 2 weeks after the communist government fell, 10,000 people walked to Red Army Square and renamed it Jan Panich Square. All right. I was in Venceslas Square when the most, at one point, well-known singer in Czechoslovakia, Marta Kubashaya, walked out onto that balcony. In 1968, she had sung an anthem of defiance that was broadcast over the airwaves. And when Dubček was overthrown, her entire recording stock was destroyed. She was never allowed to be heard again on the airwaves, and she had spent the intervening years working on an assembly line in a toy factory. And I watched her walk out on that balcony and sing that anthem, and every Czech in the crowd knew every word. Acts of resistance are moral acts, and they keep alive hope. They keep alive the possibility of reform. They speak finally even to the corrupt centers of power themselves. So that when Erich Honecker decides to crush the movement in Leipzig and sends down an elite paratroop division to fire on the crowd, they refuse to do so. And Honecker lasts another week in office. And our system is that decayed and that corrupt. And that is why they shut down the Occupy movement, because they're terrified.
Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt by Chris Hedges.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.